The moment a Russian bomb hit the maternity hospital number 3 in Mariupol, Ukraine. Women in labor were injured, 4 people were killed, 1 infant stillborn. It's an attack that's become emblematic of the brutal war from the air Vladimir Putin is waging against the people of Ukraine. And for weeks, to every foreign government he addresses via video from Kyiv, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has been making the same plea.
Russian troops have already fired nearly 1,000 missiles at Ukraine. Countless bombs. They use drones to kill us with precision. This is a terror that Europe has not seen for 80 years, and we are asking for a reply, for an answer to this terror from the whole world. Is this a lot to ask for? To create a no-fly zone over Ukraine to save people, is this too much to ask?
That was from Zelensky's address to the United States Congress last week. For all its deep emotional resonance, Zelensky's pleas have produced little material change. No NATO leader has come out in support of a no-fly zone thus far. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said last week that President Biden isn't, quote, a voice of restraint, and that he's authorized billions of dollars in support of Ukraine's military. However,
it is also true that the president has to look at decisions that are made through the prism of what is in our national security interests and global security interests. And he continues to believe that a no-fly zone would be escalatory, could prompt a war with Russia. I don't believe there's a lot of advocates calling for that at this point in time from Capitol Hill, but we certainly understand and recognize that is still a call from President Zelensky.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Modern no-fly zones have been used 3 times in the past 30 years, in Iraq, Bosnia, and Libya. Today, we'll take a look at what it takes to establish a no-fly zone, why the stakes are different with Ukraine and Russia, and whether there are options, other options, to protect Ukrainians on the ground. Joining us is Lieutenant General David Deptula. He commanded the U.S.-led no-fly zone over northern Iraq at the end of the 1990s. He's now dean of the Mitchell Institute of Aerospace Power Studies. General Deptula, welcome to you.
Hey, thanks very much, Meghna. It's great to be here.
Also with us today is John Kornblum. He served as U.S. ambassador to Germany from 1997 to 2001, and also as assistant secretary of state in the Clinton administration, where he helped architect the Dayton Peace Agreement in 1995 that ended the Bosnian War. Ambassador Kornblum has signed, is one of 27 signatories to an open letter calling for a limited no-fly zone in Ukraine. Ambassador Kornblum, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Okay. So let me start, first of all, by just getting a sense from both of you about whether or not you think NATO should answer President Zelensky's repeated call for some kind of closure of the airspace over Ukraine. And Ambassador Kornblum, let me just start with you. You get first take here.
Well, your introduction to this program very clearly described the problem. Russian forces on the ground are not moving forward as they hope to be. And the Russians are doing as they have done in Syria most recently, using a sort of scorched earth policy. They're going to destroy cities and destroy people, probably without any concern about who is being destroyed, rather than moving forward militarily. This presents the West, the United States in particular, but all of the Western allies, with not only a practical dilemma, but a moral dilemma. Are we going to sit by and watch these people being destroyed by a country which cannot deal with them on any of the normal bases of diplomacy or international law? That's a very big challenge for us. That's point one. I would only add, however, that it's quite understandable that democracies have a much different foundation for making decisions than an autocracy such as Russia does. Putin appears to be able to do more or less what he wants. Our president or the allied leaders have public opinion, they have political situations, they have the interests of their own countries. So this is not a simple issue at all. That's why the group that I joined to sign the letter called for a limited no-fly zone to help evacuate refugees and for humanitarian purposes. this is something much more doable, I'm told. I'm no expert on this, but I'm told that it is. And it would also show that we are focusing on those people who deserve to be helped the most. Mm.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about what a limited no-fly zone might mean. But Lieutenant General Deptula, same question to you. What do you think about even the possibility of that?
Well, first, Meghna, it's important for people to understand just what a no-fly zone is. It's not some sort of magical wand that you wave and the enemy gets dispersed without bloodshed. Nothing could be further from reality. A no-fly zone is not a half measure. It's a full-up and complete combat operation that's designed to eliminate all enemy air power, in this case, Russian air power, over Ukraine, as well as the associated areas where enemy air operations originate, and that means Russia. It involves direct and sustained combat with the Russians. So, you know, if NATO and the United States is going to engage in a no-fly zone, that is a declaration of war with the Russian government and Putin. Now, President Zelensky has stated his number one priority is to control the air over Ukraine. And he's right. He's absolutely right. But in summary, kind of up front, what I'd tell you, and is because of that, we need to provide President Zelensky and his forces the means to achieve air superiority on their own. Mm. This is not unlike what Winston Churchill told Franklin Roosevelt in 1941. Zelensky's saying the same thing, and that's give us the tools and we'll finish the job.
Mm. Okay. So is what you're saying, Mr. Deptula, that there is no imaginable scenario that you can think of that if any kind of no-fly zone were established, there's no imaginable scenario that wouldn't lead to escalation with NATO and
absolutely.
Russia?
Okay. No, absolutely not. And I'll be happy to describe to you what goes into a no-fly zone, and you'll be able to see for yourself what I'm talking about.
Well, we do want to hear about that in a little bit because of your direct experience in establishing a no-fly zone in Iraq. But let me first get Ambassador Kornblum to respond to that. I mean, it seems like you would disagree, Ambassador. Go ahead.
Well, no, I'm not going to disagree because I obviously am not an expert. I have not run no-fly zones. I'm not a military officer. I was, however, in charge of the European Bureau in the State Department when we did do the no-fly zone over Bosnia with a much different opponent, of course. But I think at least one American aircraft was shot down in that no-fly mm-hmm. zone. Mm-hmm. I think the issue here is not that – I'm sure the general is correct. It's far from me to disagree with him. The issue here is are the United States and the West going to stick to – things that we can't do or threaten with things that we could do. And this is a way, if you read this letter that I signed carefully, that is more or less what it says. In other words, it's again, and I say this having worked in this area for 35 years as a diplomat, and I understand the pressures on the leaders. But the fact is that right now, our approach is granting more or less the narrative, the initiative for this operation to the Russians. We are saying, no, we can't do a no-fly zone. No, we won't have troops on the ground. No, NATO won't be involved in this. No, NATO can't do that. What we can do is help you do it yourself. Okay, that's fine. What we can do is help take care of refugees when they come out. That's fine. But if we're part of an operation like this, part of an attack such as this is also psychological. And on the one hand, Putin is losing very badly in the presentation of his forces. On the other hand, he is maintaining the initiative, shall we say, in what he can do on the ground in Ukraine, because the Ukrainian army is fighting very heroically, but he does have this air power, which and these missiles, by the way, I understand the missiles are more important mm-hmm. than airplanes are, that are causing unbelievable death and destruction, and giving a picture of what the West is agreeing to accept, which is simply not acceptable.
Yeah.
So we're really caught in the middle. I understand that. And that's the reason why many of us felt that we needed to be a little bit more, maybe even to a large extent, more ambitious in what we were saying and how we were portraying our position there.
Understood. And I'm looking at the letter right now, and it says fairly clearly that a U.S. NATO-enforced no-fly zone to protect humanitarian corridors and additional military means for Ukrainian self-defense are desperately needed. And you say, the letter states clearly right at the beginning, that NATO leaders should convey to Russian officials that they do not seek direct confrontation with Russian forces. But they must also make it clear they will not countenance Russian attacks on civilian areas. So, Lieutenant General Devtula, just respond directly to what the ambassador is saying about using some sort of geopolitical means by which to seize the narrative back, at the very least, from Vladimir Putin. Do you think that some kind of limited no-fly zone, or at least the beginning of talking about that, might achieve that goal?
The short answer is no. At the same time, I absolutely agree with the intent that the ambassador is talking about. I believe wholeheartedly that Putin's rhetoric to date is doing more to deter action by NATO to assist Ukraine than NATO is doing to deter Putin from his atrocious, inhumane assaults against Ukrainian people. And I would tell you it is time for America and NATO to reverse this situation by providing Ukrainians the tools that they need to fight and win. So once again, the way to do that is to provide the equipment to the Ukrainians who are willing to use it to maintain air superiority.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the fact that the no-fly zone, I think it's harmful to use that term. The term is air supremacy, air superiority. That's what needs to be established.
Well, when we come back, I'd like to do a little learning with both of you about what history tells us about no-fly zones. So we'll do that after a quick one-minute break. Lieutenant General David Devtula and Ambassador John Kornblum, stand by. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about President Volodymyr Zelensky's repeated call for NATO to establish a no-fly zone over Ukraine, or at least to close the skies, as he says, over Ukraine. What would that actually mean? What are the potential benefits? What are the risks? And are there other ways to help Ukrainians as Russia continues to rain down bombs on Ukraine's cities? I'm joined today by John Kornblum. He served as U.S. ambassador to Germany and also assistant secretary of state in the Clinton administration. Lieutenant General David Devtula joins us as well. He's a retired U.S. Air Force officer and commander of the U.S.-led no-fly zone over northern Iraq back in the early 90s. He's currently dean of the Mitchell Institute of Aerospace Power Studies. And gentlemen, I'd like to actually spend quite a bit of time reflecting on what history has to say about the use of no-fly zones here. So let's go back to the early 90s, because, of course, the first no-fly zone that we've been talking about was established over northern Iraq in 1991 to protect ethnic Kurds. A year later, then-President George H.W. Bush announced a second no-fly zone over southern Iraq.
And therefore, the United States and its coalition partners have today informed the Iraqi government that 24 hours from now, coalition aircraft, including those of the United States, will begin flying surveillance missions in southern Iraq, south of the 32 degrees north latitude, to monitor the situation there. This will provide coverage of the areas where a majority of the most significant recent violations of Resolution 688 have taken place. The coalition is also informing Iraq's government that in order to facilitate these monitoring efforts, it is establishing a no-fly zone for all Iraqi fixed and rotary wing aircraft. This new prohibition will also go into effect in 24 hours over this same area. It'll remain in effect until the coalition determines that it is no longer required.
President George H.W. Bush there. Lieutenant General Deptula, so walk us through how that happened. First of all, what was the first thing that was needed to be done on the ground before even coalition jets went into the sky to patrol Iraqi airspace?
The first thing that needs to be done is the preparation of all the elements that go into establishing and then sustaining a no-fly zone. So it's important to recognize there's significant preparation involved. And let me share with you and give your audience some feel for what's required to do that. First, you've got to have command and control aircraft in the airspace, or monitoring the airspace is a better way to say it, such as the Airborne Warning and Control System, which is known as AWACS. Then you have to have a sufficient number of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance aircraft, like the RC-135 rivet joint, which listens to communications as well as electronic signals emitting from adversary surface-to-air missile systems and data links and other command and control communications. Today, we also use the RQ Floor Global Hawk high-altitude drone, MQ-9s, U-2s, and the like. Mm. Then you've got a set of aircraft that are known as suppression of enemy air defense aircraft. These are planes like the Navy's EF-18G that jams acquisition radars and also employs high-speed anti-radiation missiles against enemy surface-to-air missile systems. Also F-16 CJs, again, aircraft that are configured specifically to deal with an adversary's surface-to-air missile threat.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got the counter-air aircraft. These are the airplanes that defend against against the adversary aircraft that might incur into the area that's being protected by this no-fly zone. This, back in the case of northern Iraq, F-15Cs, as well as F-16s were the principal U.S. aircraft used in conducting this kind of a no-fly zone. Today, we'd use F-22s and F-35s because of their stealth characteristics. Then you need a series of strike assets. These are aircraft that can carry weapons to a large degree. The principal aircraft that we used in northern Iraq was the F-15E. F-18s as well as F-16s. And of course, you've got to be able to refuel all these airplanes to sustain operations. So you've got tanker aircraft like the KC-135. In northern Iraq, we operated with our coalition partners, the Royal Air Force. They had Nimrod tankers. And then on top of all of this, you've got to have a combat search and rescue capability provided by helicopters like the HH-60 in the event that an aircraft happens to go down.
And would you require, just to sort of, I'm trying to link it now to briefly to proposals about what might be used in Ukraine. I mean, would you require all of that support, no matter what the no-fly zone is, even if it's like a humanitarian corridor, as some have called for?
It's a great question, Meghna. Let me offer and pose this situation to you. Well, I think the Russians are up to attacking over 44 hospitals, 161 schools, and their most recent atrocity involved an attack on a shopping mall in Kyiv. So, given their callous and intentional heinous behavior, What makes anyone think that they wouldn't shoot down a humanitarian airlift operation? I mean, given their behavior, I would expect them to do that, which then requires for any such kind of a humanitarian airlift to succeed without getting those airplanes shot down, they would require a significant amount of combat aircraft that could protect them and defend them against Russian air attack. So you're going to introduce combat aircraft regardless of what you call the air operation. Hmm. Whether it's a humanitarian airlift or not, one has to analyze the enemy that we're going up against. And they've demonstrated that not only are they not concerned about civilian casualties, they're intentionally attacking civilians to kill them.
Yeah. So I'm going to, Ambassador Kornblum, I'm going to come back to you in just a second here, but I do actually kind of want to get a little bit more of the logistical expertise from Lieutenant General Deftula here. So in Iraq, for the no-fly zone, two quick things. One is, what specifically was the mission? Was it to engage with and shoot down any, I mean, we heard President Bush there a little bit earlier, but any Iraqi aircraft or missiles? And how effective was the no-fly zone back in the early 90s?
Okay, well, that's a great, it's a wonderful question. The purpose of the no-fly zone was to prevent the Iraqis from using aircraft to attack the Kurds in the north, quite simply. With respect to its effectiveness, it was very effective. And I can tell you that at least during my time there, while we didn't shoot down any Iraqi aircraft because none attempted to penetrate the no-fly zone, because of our presence, a no-fly zone does have attendant consequences for the area in which it's imposed over. Hmm. Just to give you some sense of what occurred in 99, when I was a Northern Watch commander, we destroyed more than 140 large caliber anti-aircraft artillery guns. We destroyed more than 30 surface-to-air missile radars. We destroyed more than 15 surface-to-air missile launchers. And we destroyed dozens of command and control vans and command and control facilities, just as an example, among many other elements of the Iraqi integrated air defense system.
Yeah.
So don't, what I want your audience to understand is, don't think that this is just about shooting down airplanes. It's also about protecting the no-fly zone force, which means eliminating the surface-to-air missile threat, as well as their command and control elements that would be posed against the no-fly zone force.
And indeed, earlier you'd said that it also would include, targeting where the enemy's air operations originate, which is also quite interesting. But Ambassador Kornblum, I appreciate you listening along here with me. We'll get to the no-fly zone over Bosnia in just a second, but just what reflections do you have when you listen to what Lieutenant General Deftula describes as the efforts that went into creating that no-fly zone over Iraq?
Well, it's very interesting, as you said, and that was a very specific case. I took part, was actually quite directly involved in the management of the no-fly zone over Bosnia, especially after 1994. And that was a much different situation, but also in many ways more complicated, because there were NATO forces under a UN flag on the ground at that time, and many of them were taken hostage because of the no-fly zone. And so we had to also negotiate over the safety and ultimately release of the hostages. It was a very complex political, military, if we can call it that, operation. So again, yes, this is all very complex stuff, but the United States is the most experienced and most powerful country on the planet, and we should be in business of doing complex stuff. And that's why, again, to go back to the letter that maybe it's the basis for this discussion. I think that the letter makes very clear that the signatories understood how complex this was, but made at the same time the point that we simply cannot sit by and watch a country being sort of erased from the face of the earth. Mm.
You know, I note that in Bosnia, that was a no-fly zone that was established as, at the time, Admiral Mike Borda pointed out, a NATO no-fly zone that was operating in what he called an out-of-area location, right? Non-NATO airspace, essentially.
Right.
But that also did lead—I mean, there were significant engagements in that no-fly zone. I'm thinking, you know, you mentioned this earlier, Ambassador Kornblum, the shooting down of an American pilot in 1995. Captain Tom O'Grady was downed as he was helping enforce that no-fly zone over Bosnia. He had to spend 6 days hiding behind enemy lines before being rescued. So here's a moment, his homecoming, featuring President Bill Clinton and John Shalikasvili, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Captain O'Grady was flying over Bosnia, doing his part to deny the skies to those who would rain death and destruction upon that war-torn land below. But as we all now know, in the early morning hours of 2 June, the course of Captain O'Grady's life took a dramatic turn. And for 6 long days, people around the world, his family, his friends, every American, waited impatiently for news of his fate.
Ambassador Kornblum, I'm wondering if how much you recall that event and what it meant for, or what impact it had, if any, on the mission of that no-fly zone over Bosnia.
Well, I recall the event very well. I was sitting in the State Department much of the time doing my part and trying to help and manage it. It didn't change history as such, but I think we can say that after several years of frustration and literally tens of thousands of deaths at the hands of the Bosnian Serbs, who were every bit as ruthless as the Russians seem to be today, that it was the introduction of NATO air power, and in particular the sponsorship, or shall we say the support of it by the United States, which did slowly turn things around. And it took us still between the beginning of the no-fly zone, it took us over 2 years to finally end the war through a negotiated settlement, by the way. But without that air power, I have in my head right now many discussions that we had, and some of them were not the most agreeable ones with our NATO allies over use of this air power. It was the use of that air power which, in fact, probably turned the direction of that the Bosnian War was taking. I know that I was one of the main negotiators of the Dayton Agreement. We knew that we couldn't do that without the support of the air power. So, again, I'm going to go back to the point. I agree completely with the complexity of it and the points that General Dutula has made. And the point that I think that we were trying to make in this letter was, this is not a simple question, do you do it or you don't do it? This is a very complex political, military, diplomatic situation, and it should be within the realm of the possible for these immensely experienced countries who form NATO to come up with a strategy which helps us protect the people on the ground. Right now, it's a disaster. In Bosnia, by the way, it was a disaster, too. Tens of thousands of people were killed, including 7,000 in one day in Srebrenica. And so we understood very much what the stakes were, and that's why we pushed very hard to do what we did. And I would hope that our letter stimulated a discussion, which we're having here today, on the kinds of things that we can do to make sure that those kinds of numbers aren't repeated in Ukraine.
Mm. Well, Lieutenant General Dutula, we've got about 30 seconds before I have to take that next break, but just respond directly to what Ambassador Kornblum has said a couple of times here now, that NATO and particularly the United States military can do complicated things. So why not something over in the Ukrainian skies?
Well, first, I agree wholeheartedly with the ambassador's intent, which is to assure the that the Ukrainians can achieve and maintain air superiority over Ukraine. The question becomes, do you want to engage NATO in direct combat with Russia in order to be able to do that? Or is there a way to do that by providing the appropriate equipment to the Ukrainian armed forces for them to be able to accomplish that objective themselves?
So that's what we'll talk about more when we take a quick break. So Lieutenant General David Deptula, Ambassador John Kornblum, hang in here for just a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A no-fly zone. That's what we're talking about today as the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky continues to call for NATO support in closing the skies over Ukraine. So we're hashing it out. What are no-fly zones? How have they been used in the past? What form of one, if any, should be even considered in Ukraine? What would be the consequences of taking that step? It doesn't have that much support, let's be honest, right now in Washington, but it's an idea worth pursuing because if we've learned anything from history, it's that we must be prepared for what might happen next. So I'm relying on the expertise today of Ambassador John Kornblum. He is former U.S. ambassador to Germany, also served as Assistant Secretary of State in the Clinton administration. He helped architect the Dayton Peace Agreement in 1995 that ended the war in Bosnia. And he recently was one of some 27 signatories to an open letter calling for a limited no-fly zone in Ukraine. I'm also joined by Lieutenant General David Deptula. He's a retired U.S. Air Force officer, former commander of the U.S.-led no-fly zone over northern Iraq in the 90s, currently dean of the Mitchell Institute of Aerospace Power Studies. Now, let's just listen to some of the voices in Washington that are adamantly opposed to any kind of no-fly zone. Here's Minnesota Congresswoman Democrat Ilhan Omar.
Increasingly, we are hearing voices calling for the United States and NATO to enter into war with Russia. For the most part, they are not saying this directly. They are using euphemisms like no-fly zone. A no-fly zone is not simply declared. It must be militarily enforced. As the president said, a no-fly zone would mean the United States entering the war. It would mean the beginning of World War III. We must reject this completely.
Now, Ambassador Kornblum and Lieutenant General Deptula, let's just further engage with the obvious for a moment here, because yes, both of you said in Iraq, in Bosnia, we didn't talk that much about Libya, but in all three places in the past 30 years, the no-fly zones were successful in achieving the missions, the stated missions in each of those countries. But of course, there was overwhelming air superiority in each one of the cases. And, you know, if something happened in Ukraine, perhaps NATO and the United States would also have overwhelming air superiority. But it's what happens next that's the concern, because what happens next is engagement with Russia, which could happen even if, I don't know, you know, a NATO pilot shot down missiles instead of Russian aircraft. I mean, in a sense, Ambassador Kornblum, I'm going to start with you. Is it possible at all that while President Zelensky, of course, has every reason in the world, millions of them, in fact, to call for a no-fly zone, could it be the thing that also Vladimir Putin wants? Because it would give him an excuse to immediately escalate.
Well, we don't know what's in his mind, of course. But I would turn the question around to you and say, if we keep saying that there's nothing we can do about it, aren't we in fact encouraging him to try to do more? We had an event over the last weekend, I think it was, which certainly caught my attention and the attention of many other people. That is, the Russians sent a missile into, I think it was a airplane repair facility or something in the city of Lviv. And that missile landed less than 20 miles away from the Polish border. The Polish border is also NATO's border. So that's either that was a mistake, or Putin and his people believe that they can test us all the way up to the limits of NATO territory and maybe even beyond. So again, this is not, I'm not calling for a war, obviously, with Russia. I think that the Congresswoman was slightly overdramatic in the way she provided it. But I think that the fact is that we have, as I said earlier, and I think this is can be demonstrated, we have lost control of the narrative here. We are being defensive against Russian behavior. Take a look at the way people reacted with really excitement and even fear when Putin said, I have placed our nuclear forces on alert. Well, I don't know what kind of alert he was talking about, but just simply the fact that he mentioned nuclear forces seemed to send people back even further away from any action. So again, this is not a simple question. I understand that. But it's also not a simple and not a good question simply to be ignoring what could happen if we don't exert ourselves.
Understood. And, you know, we're going to spend some time talking about what other things that could happen here. But I just wonder, Ambassador, it's a terrible, terrible calculus to have to make. But sometimes is it not the inevitable one that when you're talking about the potential clash of the two largest militaries in two of the largest militaries in the world, and then plus many more if we're talking about NATO overall, that in the end, tragically, sometimes it may mean for the greater good that doing nothing is the best option?
Could be. I'm not going to say that's not the case, but I don't think that it's important to test that consideration. I will give you one personal experience that I had, which perhaps colors my thinking, but that's what happens to all of us. One Saturday morning in July of 1995, I was actually at Martha's Vineyard on vacation. And I turned on my little radio in my kitchen there and heard that 7,000 people had been killed in a city called Srebrenica, which we had just a few days earlier made clear that we would defend the Bosnians who were in that city from Serbian attacks. Instead, they were taken in buses and killed. Was this a mistake that we had made there? And yes, it turned out to have been a mistake. We hadn't thought about the security of these people. We hadn't thought about what the forces there needed to be doing. But the fact is that the forces there were several hundred Dutch soldiers who didn't have the correct armaments and who didn't have the correct instructions for what they were supposed to be doing. In other words, we're talking here about something which could flow into a broader war, whether we wanted it to or not. And we have to be thinking about all of the possibilities and all the options and not simply say we can't do something because it's Russia and they've got nuclear weapons. This sort of, I think, was the purpose of this letter. And we cannot live again with the same feelings that we had after World War II. We mentioned that in the letter, too, the refrain, never again, concerning the Holocaust. We have to be sure that we're doing what can be done, and I don't want to suggest going beyond certain borders, what can be done to make sure that the West has not allowed another massacre to take place.
Except we do that all the time, though, Ambassador. I mean, I hear what you're saying with deep respect, but Yemen, Syria, et cetera, we say never again. Rwanda, I mean, Congo, I could go on. And yet it happens again and again. What makes this different?
Right.
What makes
this different? I agree with you completely. And those examples are not, shall we say, high points of American diplomatic history. That doesn't mean against a past which has blemishes on it that you don't try in the future not to do the same thing again. That's all we're saying in the signatories of the letter. Mm. make sure that we try to avoid the kind of crises, the kind of massacres, the kind of horrible situations which have existed in the past and probably will exist in the future also.
I want to bring Lieutenant General Deptula in here again quickly, make some space for him. I appreciate you listening, but I want to definitely get your response. Lieutenant General, go ahead.
Magno, let me once again say I share the ambassador's perspective in terms of doing something, anything that we can to assist the Ukrainians in halting acts, crimes against humanity that are being committed by Putin and the Russians. That said, we have to be very careful that we don't paint the discussion topic today, a no-fly zone, as a binary yes or no. Mm-hmm. There are options, and I tried to interject one right up front, and that's that we can give President Zelensky the tools that he needs to achieve a greater degree of air superiority than he has. That's the ultimate objective of a no-fly zone, air superiority.
Tools meaning aircraft and things like that?
Right, aircraft. Aircraft are required to achieve air superiority over a particular space. So I share the ambassador's concern that the United States and NATO have been deterred by Russia. A perfect case in point is the whole issue of the transfer of the Polish MiG-29s, which is the principal aircraft that the Ukrainians are using to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, that whole thing was a diplomatic kerfuffle that should never have occurred in public. It's a no-brainer. It should have already happened without all the fanfare going on in the media. But the fact of the matter is, the MiG-29s would allow the Ukrainians to sustain their force to assist them in achieving their own no-fly zone.
Yeah.
So that's the direction we need to go toward.
So,
and that's moving the equipment to the Ukrainians that actually makes a difference, not 5-pound drones that aren't even drones at all. They're just small weapons.
Mm-hmm. So providing the Ukrainians with the tools for achieving that air superiority, as you said, equipment, aircraft, et cetera, one possibility. Now, I want to actually explore some other ideas, too. Again, it's not yes or no. There could be other options. So, interestingly, one of those ideas comes from Douglas Feith. Now, he was Assistant Secretary of State under President George W. Bush and was a leading architect of the 2003 invasion of Iraq and the subsequent war. And I must note that that subsequent war killed 4,000 U.S. soldiers, wounded 32,000 U.S. soldiers, and killed an estimated 200,000 Iraqis. And Doug Feith doesn't seem to be spending much time worrying if all of Neptune's ocean would wash that blood clean from his hands. But now, when he looks at Ukraine, he opposes a no-fly zone, but recently proposed a U.S.-backed humanitarian airlift in support of Ukraine.
Large amounts of humanitarian supplies, food and medicine, et cetera, could be flown in. And we could ask countries that are not particularly threatening to Russia, such as India, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, maybe Brazil, to take the lead in bringing in these humanitarian supplies.
Now, Doug Feith admits that Vladimir Putin could reject the plan, threaten to shoot down the humanitarian airlift planes, even do so. But to Feith, that's the whole point.
It would present a challenge to President Putin that he would either allow it or have to threaten to shoot down humanitarian aircraft. And one hopes that he would not want to be in a position of blocking or threatening humanitarian aircraft, and that we would be able to get substantial supplies into Ukraine.
And he says that plan could actually cause a rift within Putin's government.
even if Putin himself would not be moved by, you know, an appeal to allow in the humanitarian supplies, it's possible that people around Putin would be very uneasy with Russia being put in a position of rejecting a, you know, Brazilian, Egyptian, Indian, or whatever proposal to send in humanitarian supplies, and it might create debate and aggravate tensions between Putin and his advisors. And that's the kind of tension and pressure that we think would be constructive and could help pressure Putin into softening his position. I don't think that there's a lot that the West can do to soften Putin. But if Putin starts seeing cracks in his own ruling circles, that's the kind of pressure that could actually influence his policy.
Douglas Feith, former Assistant Secretary of State under President George W. Bush and currently a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. Now, we only have 2 minutes left here, so I'm going to give a minute to each of you. Ambassador Kornblum, your response. What do you make of that suggestion?
Well, I think that everything is worth a try. I doubt very much that such a project would work for a whole lot of reasons we won't go into. I think, again, I just make the basic point of myself and the people who signed this letter. Let's start thinking harder about what we can do to help save these lives and these cities in Ukraine and not say we can't do it because the Russians have nuclear weapons.
Mm. Well, then, Lieutenant General David Deptula, tell me, what would you then like to see happens next? What should the Biden administration do? What kind of conversations do you want to see happening at NATO? Give me some sense as to next steps that wouldn't lead down the path that you fear the most in terms of a direct engagement with Russia.
Well, once again, my message has been that we need to provide the equipment and the tools to the Ukrainians to be able to achieve and maintain air superiority over their own country. So that includes things like the transfer of the kinds of aircraft they're already flying that are absolutely available. They've been offered by the Poles. These are the MiG-29s to Ukraine. Because what the impact would be is the armed forces of Ukraine, they've got the military personnel who know how to operate these systems and are experienced in working them. It would provide them the opportunity to increase their ability to destroy additional Russian planes that are bombing Ukrainian cities. Russian aviation activities would be limited because they wouldn't be able to operate in a sustained manner against this kind of force. So the fact of the matter is, what I offer is all is fair in providing weapons to Ukraine up to U.S.-NATO direct participation in combat. Because as the ambassadors indicated as well, of what I believe is Putin won't be stopped without resistance. The Ukrainians are fighting on behalf of the complete free world, and therefore we need to support him to the greatest degree possible, not the least that we can get by with, according to the Pentagon lawyers.
Well, Lieutenant General David Deptula and Ambassador John Kornblum, very grateful that both of you could join us this hour. Thank you so much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.